Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. The MSS crew is back on the attack here in the Fred Bertelsen Memorial Old Time Radio Room of RadioOutOfThePast.org. We thank you for joining us today, November 19th, 2016. And as always, this is Luis Jr., assisting with bringing to you yet another exciting and exhilarating internet broadcast of Michael's Saturday Night Surprise. Well, folks, as promised, we have another surprise lined up and ready to unleash for your listening enjoyment. And on top of the OTR surprise, we have a new member of the MSS crew who will be joining us tonight for his inaugural presentation. Just so happens to be a regular around the OTR circuit, as well as a loyal MSS fan, and now he has joined the MSS crew. All of you might be familiar with this gentleman. He's another one of those Canadian mother Canuckers, and he goes by the name of Bobby Braxma. Yep, Bob Braxma has joined the crew, and the boat guy is now ready to do his thing and enthrall you with his version of old-time radio. So, without any further delays, I would just ask if everyone could please sit back, grab your favorite drinks and snacks, and enjoy the program. Bobby, the microphone is yours.
Good evening, and welcome to Michael's Saturday Night Surprise.
Round up time will soon be here, my darling, out where the breezes hum a tune. Come, let us take a stroll together out underneath the silvery moon. When round up time in sunny old Alberta, here's round up time in this heart of mine. Round up time for cattle on the prairie, out where the gleaming campfire shines. There's a little church on the hillside, there's where the wedding bells will chime. When round up time in sunny old Alberta, it's round up time in this old heart of mine. Oh, dear, dear, dear. And banjos playing, greeting as we pass along the way. There'll be wedding bells ringing on our happy round-up wedding day. When it's round-up time in sunny old Alberta, it's round-up time in this heart of mine. Round-up time for cattle on the prairie, out where the gleaming campfire shines. There's a little church on the hillside, there's where the wedding bells will chime. When it's round-up time in sunny old Alberta, it's round-up time in this old heart of mine. Oh, dear, dear, dear.
That was Wilf Carter singing It's Roundup Time in sunny old Alberta, Alberta, Canada. I'm your host tonight. My name is Bob, and I live in Alberta, Canada. And it gives me great pleasure to present to you, from 1948, a documentary called Canada's New Farmland. It speaks about the Peace River District of Alberta, Canada in 1948. Enjoy.
In Canada, we are still pushing back the wilderness of our vast northern country to create new farmlands and to develop new resources. One of our modern frontiers is the district around the Peace River in the province of Alberta. The Peace River has its source in the Canadian Rockies, where moisture carried by winds from the Pacific Ocean turns into snow. Because our mountain region is so beautiful, we have set aside great areas of land for national parks. Here, all wildlife is protected, and not even trees may be cut. The slow-melting glaciers and the snowfields of the mountains feed the rivers of Western Canada. From the Rockies, the rivers flow in two directions. Many of them flow west through British Columbia to the Pacific Ocean. Others flow east. The Peace River is one of these. It gives its name to the frontier district in the province of Alberta, where we are developing our newest farmlands. Until 50 years ago, tribes of Indians hunted and fished in the wilderness around the Peace River. But in 1916, when a railroad connecting with other parts of Canada was completed, the first settlers moved into the region. Because the soil of the Peace River country is so fertile, it is becoming one of the important grain-producing areas of Canada. In this northernmost farm country, the summers are short, but the long hours of daylight make it possible for big crops of grain to ripen. Barley and rye grow well. Oats can be harvested within a few weeks of planting. Although more difficult to raise, wheat is the principal crop. Our farmers plant a variety of grains because in some seasons too little or too much rain or early or late frosts may damage the wheat. As long as the world needs more of our grain, new farmlands will be carved out of the wilderness. This wilderness is made up of a light forest growth, and its soil can be made productive. In one part of the Peace River District, our government is encouraging new settlement by clearing away large tracts of forest. The trees are uprooted with tractors and bulldozers. In flat country, and on gently rolling hills, machinery can be used easily, and the land can be cleared quickly. The roots and grasses in the thick topsoil are loosened by tractors and disc breakers. Although much of the rough land is being cleared and made ready by the government, the new settlers build their own homes and farm buildings. On the frontier, the men do their own carpentry and plumbing, and the women become their hard-working assistants. Often one can tell how long a farmer has been on his land by the number and size of his buildings. After providing a house for his family, he goes on to build a barn for his animals. Throughout the Peace River District, in areas away from the railroad and highways, where the only roads are overgrown paths cut through the woods by the early settlers, there are still thousands of undeveloped acres. A great many of the modern-day pioneers are war veterans, willing to share the hardships of frontier life in return for the opportunity of developing farms of their own. Roy and Ina Grimsrud are Norwegians who trained with the Canadian Army. They have decided to make homes for themselves on the undeveloped land of the Peace River country. Many young men like them are taking advantage of the generous offers which our government makes to those who will establish homesteads in our wilderness. Now and again, Roy and Ina must stop to broaden the narrow trail. Like true pioneers, the brothers bring all their possessions with them. They have at last reached the tract of land allotted to them by the government on the condition that it will be cleared and farmed. To war veterans like Roy and Ina, the government also gives more than $2,000 with which to buy seeds, farm implements, animals, and other things needed to start their farm. Today, men who make their homes in the wilderness bring food, clothing, and shelter with them. Water is drawn from a stream nearby. It will be a long time before Roy and Ina can sink their own well. During the first few months, they must use the provisions they have brought with them sparingly. The hope of someday being able to have a home of their own and land enough to grow their own food has sent generations of pioneers to new frontiers. Throughout the ages, men like the Grimsrud brothers have endured many hardships in order to gain the satisfaction of creating a homestead with their own hands. Roy and Ina know that only by clearing and cultivating their new land and by harvesting crops that can be sold will they be able to remain here permanently. Although modern pioneering has the same spirit of adventure and the same rewards for hard work, it has fewer of the hardships of early days. The work is made easier by the use of a tractor borrowed from a friendly farmer in the neighborhood. During the first summer, Roy and Ina hope to clear enough land to plant and harvest one field of grain. When the first field of grain has been sown, the brothers have enough time to work on the house they are building. Although they are pioneers on a new frontier, Roy and Ina have no desire to spend a long and cold winter in the tent that has been their home. Like all farmers in the Peace River district of Western Canada, Roy and Ina are anxious about the weather. They want to be able to harvest and sell their first crop of oats as quickly as possible. Autumn rains could delay the harvest, and a heavy frost might ruin the season's work. But when more fields have been cleared, the brothers will plant several kinds of grain, so that if one crop fails, there will be others to depend upon. A symbol of our rich grain lands are the tall towers by the railroad. These are called grain elevators, and the harvests of scores of farms are stored here until the grain is shipped to the markets and mills. Some of our small towns consist of little more than these great storage bins. Grand Prairie is one of the largest grain centers in the Peace River region. But in many ways, it is still a frontier community that is constantly expanding to meet the needs of new settlers. Grand Prairie has become big enough to have its own weekly newspaper. Merchants use it to advertise their goods to farmers who live in the district, and its news columns keep the settlers informed of local happenings. The bank in a frontier town is of particular service to farmers who often need money until their crops are sold. It also arranges government loans to settlers. So many farmers now have automobiles, tractors, and trucks that other men earn their living by keeping the equipment in good order. The dairy at Grand Prairie collects milk from farmers and ships what the townspeople don't use to our big cities. Grand Prairie's unpaved streets are a reminder that only a few years ago, there was nothing but wilderness where this busy town now stands. A radio station is extremely important to people living on a modern frontier. It brings the farmers weather forecasts and market reports, as well as news and entertainment from the outside world. Every day, this radio station broadcasts personal messages as a convenience to its listeners.
And to Darrell at Beaver Lodge, meet the train tomorrow night. Mother will be on it. And that sign, Josie.
In such ways, the radio helps to make life easier and more pleasant for the people who live in a modern frontier region. But there are many problems. One of the greatest is providing schoolhouses and teachers for the children who live on widely separated farms. There are many rural schoolhouses in the Peace River District with one classroom for all grades. Because few of the buildings have electric lights, the school sessions are adjusted to the hours of daylight. In the short days of the late fall and winter, classes are dismissed early in the afternoon. Few of the children who live on the outskirts of a school district can walk to and from school. Some families in each neighborhood live several miles away. The boys and girls from distant homes drive buggies or ride horseback because most of the year the dirt roads are too muddy for bicycles. When more settlers establish homes in the region, the community will be able to improve the roads and maintain a school bus. When the weather is fine, some children like to take shortcuts across the fields on their way home. Many of the oldest settlers now own prosperous farms. Such a family are the Watsons. Because they've always worked hard, the Watsons now live comfortably. When Shirley comes home from school, she helps her mother in many ways. In the summer, the Watsons have a small vegetable garden close to the house. From time to time, warm winds blow across the Peace River District and often bring rain. These strong winds sweep down from the Rockies and are called Chinooks. Shirley's father is one of the most successful farmers in the neighborhood. He has worked hard ever since the day 30 years ago when he arrived in the district by ox cart. Mr. and Mrs. Watson are proud of the home they built themselves and enlarged to meet the needs of the family. The Watsons' kitchen is one of the best equipped in the neighborhood. Well water is piped to the sink, and the family's meals are cooked on a fine wood-burning range. The Watsons depend on their livestock to provide food and a small addition to their income. When the hogs have grown fat, they will be sold to the livestock dealer and shipped to packing houses. Cattle raising and dairying are profitable for the Watsons, as for many of the grain farmers. In the busy summer months, when crops must be tended, the care of the cows adds more hours of work for the Watson family. Late in the afternoon, Shirley and her brother help by rounding up the cows and driving them back to the farm for milking. Shirley has learned to handle her horse with the assurance of an expert. All winter long, when the fields are covered with snow, the cows will remain in the barn. Then there is plenty of time to feed and milk them. The busiest time of all for the Watsons and their neighbors in the Peace River District is the harvest season. On every farm, there is work enough for each member of the family. On the broad, flat grain fields of western Alberta today, farm machinery has largely replaced the teams of horses and oxen upon which the early settlers depended for planting and harvesting. Sometimes tractors, reapers, and combines are rented or borrowed, but all of the grain farmers own some mechanized equipment. Today, big combines cut the stalks of wheat, thresh out the grain, and discard the straw in a continuous operation. These big machines are so simple to operate that boys are able to run them after only a little practice. A boy at the controls of one combine can do the work of dozens of men. Farm machinery pays for itself by saving the farmer the cost of labor. If the wheat has not hardened sufficiently, it cannot be harvested with a combine. Then it must be cut and left to ripen in the fields. Frost may ruin a growing crop, but it does very little damage to grain that has been cut. When the grain that has been left in the fields is hard enough, it is threshed. Farmers help each other during the busy seasons. If neighbors spend 2 days working at the Watsons will repay them with the same amount of work. At the end of the harvest season, the yield of more than 1 million acres of farmland is brought to the grain elevators of the Peace River District. Now the farmers learn how much their crop is worth and how much money they will have to live on for the next year. At the grain elevator, there is a separate bin for each grade of wheat. For new settlers on government property, putting their grain into the elevators is another step toward full ownership of their farms. When they have farmed the land for 10 seasons, it becomes their own to do with as they please. The harvest will be sent to big cities in our country, to the United States, and much of it will be shipped overseas. Even during the busy harvest season, people come to town for church on Sundays. The church was one of the first buildings in Grand Prairie. It was built by the early settlers as an expression of gratitude for their success as pioneers. As in the early days, one Sunday in the harvest season is set aside for Thanksgiving services. Among the newest members of the congregation are the Grimsrud brothers. For Roy and Ina, the first year has been a difficult one. But they have made a good start. They have built themselves a home, and their first field has produced a fine crop. Like thousands of pioneers who are establishing homesteads on the new frontiers of Canada, Roy and Ina are looking forward to each new season and each new harvest. At the end of 10 years, the land that they are changing from a barren wilderness into rich fields of grain will become their own. The hard work of pioneers like Roy and Ina Grimsrud is responsible for the development of new farmlands in the Peace River District of Western Canada.
And so we're left with a wonderful picturesque view of Peace River and its people in 1948. Let's close this section of the broadcast with Wilf Carter and the Blue Canadian Rockies.
Oh, how my lonely heart is aching tonight for a home I long to see. And oh, what I'd give if I could be there tonight with a sweetheart who's waiting for me in my blue Canadian. spring is sighing through the trees, and the golden poppies are blooming around the banks of Lake Louise. Across the sea they call me, they sure are, and I'm lonesome and so blue, mighty blue, for my blue Canadian Rockies and the girl I love so true. In my blue Canadian Rockies, spring is sighing through the trees, and the golden poppies are a-blooming around the banks of Lake Louise. Across the sea they call me, and I'm lonesome and so blue, I'm mighty blue, for my blue Canadian Rockies and the girl that I love so true.
Time now for some good old-fashioned old-time radio.
Blair of the Mounties, the story of the Royal Canadian Mounted Police.
We present the 19th episode in Blair of the Mounties. Inspector Blair's old friend Angus MacGregor, one time Hudson's Bay factor at Fort McAllister, is now retired from service and is living in Vancouver. Our scene opens in the dusk of a summer evening. As the darkness gathers over the quiet waters of English Bay, we find Blair and Angus talking together in the garden of the MacGregor home.
Weel, no, Inspector. It was mighty good of you to drop in the next. I didn't expect you.
Why not, Angus?
Weel, I was just reading the paper about the bank robbery in the city. I was thinking you'd be busy.
That's nothing to do with me. Thank goodness.
What? Are you no working today?
Oh, yes, in a way, but crime in the city of Vancouver has nothing to do with us, unless we're invited to lend a hand. All we do nowadays is loaf round and look important. We're known in the guidebooks as the picturesque survival of other days.
Weel. Just think of that now. But, mon inspector, it's a very bad case. Would you no like to be reading the report?
No, thanks. Had enough of bank robberies. 20 years ago in Winnipeg. One of the queerest cases I ever ran across.
We'll know it's a fine night for a story. Inspector, you know, I'm awful fond of mysteries myself.
Angus, you're the most inquisitive old humbug I ever knew. Oh, well, here goes. You remember the old Canada Western Bank in Winnipeg?
I mind it well. On Portage Avenue.
That's it. I was stationed in Winnipeg then. It was the spring of 1904. I was a sergeant at the time. Marshall was there, too. One morning, he came bursting into the office when I was working on the report.
Sergeant! Have you heard the news?
News? No. For heaven's sake, shut that door.
All right. But listen, Sergeant. There's been a robbery at the Canada Western Bank. Over 100,000 in currency.
I don't care if they robbed 50 banks. What's that got to do with us? It's a job for the city police.
But hold on, Inspector. They've arrested old Danny McBrennan.
You know him, don't you? No, old Danny, rather. He used to be in the police. What on earth did they arrest Danny for?
Well, he's the night watchman at the bank. They suspect him of complicity.
Suspect old Danny? Why, that's ridiculous.
Well, they've got him anyway. And Mason, the cashier, too.
That's too bad, Marshal. I'd take my oath old Danny would never do a thing like that.
That's what I think, too.
Hold on a minute. Hello? Oh, yes, sir. Good morning. Canada Western? Yes. Marshal just told me. No, I don't understand it either. Maybe it's some mistake. Yes, I'll do that, sir. By the way, Marshal.
Yes?
We're on this case. Inspector's just given me instructions to go down to jail and see Danny. He used to be in our outfit, and we've got to help him.
I see. Yes, it'd be a nasty crack for us if they convict Danny. We'd never hear the last of it.
What do you know about this case? Any details?
Just a few. Last night at 11 o'clock, the cashier, Mason, was working late at the bank. He lives in the rooms above the bank anyway.
All right. What about Danny?
I was coming to that. About 11:05, Danny states that a man got out of a cab and walked across the pavement to the main door.
Where was Danny?
Outside on the corner. He was making his rounds.
Did he identify this man?
Sure. He says it was the manager, Blake Fishburne.
Fishburne, yes, I know him. What then?
Fishburne gave Danny a $10 bill and asked him to run along to the Craven Hotel and get him some cigars. That's practically all Danny's story.
Well, what happened?
The cashier, Mason, says that Fishburne came into the bank. He was wearing a heavy coat with a collar turned up. He told Mason to clear out and get to bed right away. Mason says the manager gave him the devil for being there so late.
Then what?
Why, when Danny got back, the manager had gone. He went upstairs and got Mason. Then Mason spotted a package of important bonds lying near the vault with the paper torn partly off one package. That made him suspicious. He opened the safe and found the currency gone.
Well, but what does the manager say?
He isn't in town.
Skipped out?
No, that's the funny part. He left for Portage la Prairie yesterday afternoon's train. He's on his way back now. The cast-iron alibi.
Quite sure about that?
Not a chance of any doubt. At 11 o'clock last night, Blake Fishburne was attending a farewell supper in Portage. All the prominent people in town were there. It's a dead sure alibi.
All right, let's go down and talk to Danny.
This way, Sergeant.
Morning, Danny.
Good morning to you, Sergeant.
Well, since I hear about you, Danny, robbing banks, getting your name in the papers, I'm surprised at you.
Don't be making a joke of it, Sergeant. Sure, it's bad enough without that.
Come on now, Danny. Brace up, my lad. Don't suppose anybody in the old crowd will ever believe this on you. We're all with you, Danny. We'll get you out of here if we have to start a war.
That's fine to be talking, Sergeant, but there's nothing you can do.
Let's have your story anyway, Danny.
Sure, it's not much yours. I've told it 3 times already. It's so crazy I'd hardly believe it myself.
Come on, Danny. I want that story just as it happened. Start at the beginning.
Well, all right. It was exactly 11:05. I came out of the alleyway at the side of the bank.
Where have you been?
Just on my usual rounds. I start at 11 with the outside of the building, checking the doors and fire escapes. It takes about 5 minutes.
All right. What happened when you came out of the alley?
Begorry, there was a cab just drawn up, and Mr. Fishbury gets out of it. And I hurried up to meet him right at the front door.
Be careful, Danny. You sure it was the manager?
Of course. I tech me day or north on it. He had a heavy coat on with a collar turned up. But I saw his face, and I heard the voice of him. Sure, now, don't I know him all of the 7 years?
All right, what next?
Well, then he pulled out a $10 bill, and he says to me, Danny, he says, I'm going into the office for a while. Go along to the Craven House and get me a half a dozen of them Long Tom cigars.
The Craven House? That'd be quite a way from the bank, eh?
Sure, 12 blocks it is now, and me walking. But it's the only place they keep them cigars.
How long did it take you?
Oh, it was 11:25 when I got back to the bank. And when I got back, the office was all dark and not a sign of the manager.
What did you do then?
Well, I thought he must be upstairs in Mr. Mason's the cashier's room, so I went up. Mason was just getting ready for bed when I told him the manager was gone. He wouldn't believe me, and we both busted downstairs into the bank.
And what did you find there?
Nothing at first. Then Mason spotted a bundle of papers, bonds they were, just by the door of the vault. He picked them up. That was when he tumbled out that the vault had been opened.
I see. So he reopened the vault, eh?
That's right, Sergeant. And then he called me. There was bonds and papers strewn all over the floor. Oh, it was a devil of a mess, it was.
No time lock on that vault?
No, there's a talk of putting one on in. Well, most of the banks have them now, but there's never been one in the old Canada Western.
How many people know the combination?
Just Mr. Fishbury and Mess.
I see. It's a bad spot for you, Danny.
Aye.
But I still don't see what right they have to arrest you. There's no tangible evidence against you.
Just one thing, Sergeant.
What is that?
That $10 bill Mr. Fishbury gave me for the cigars. It was a brand new bill. It was one of the bunch that was supposed to have been put into the vault yesterday afternoon.
Ah, I see. So the theory is that you and Mason opened the vault and got that money last night. Why, that's crazy.
That may be crazy, but it's pretty hard to get away from that bill. Our bad cess to it.
This is the truth you're telling me, Danny?
May I never speak a word again, Sergeant. It's the whole truth.
And you're sure it was Blake Fishburne, the manager you saw at the bank last night?
I'd stake my life on it.
And yet there are 30 or 40 prominent people who could swear that he was in Poison Prairie at 11 o'clock last night. It's certain he's here there this morning. He must have been there, Danny.
Aye, it looks that way. But I tell you, I saw him here last night.
They never believe you, Danny.
That's what I'm thinking.
All right. Marshall's having a talk to Mason, the cashier. I've got to go now, Danny. Cheer up now. We'll find a way to get you out of this.
Thank you for trying anyway, Sergeant.
Marshall.
Yes, Sergeant.
Get anything important?
Afraid not. Just the same thing over again with a few more details.
What do you think of this man Mason, the cashier?
Hanged if I know. His story's straight enough. It fits in with Danny's story about the manager, Fishbury, coming in just after 11 o'clock. He says the manager called him down for being in the bank at that hour. That he went straight up to his quarters, leaving the manager in the office.
Yes, hard to start a theory. Why should these two men invent that story? It's such a poor defense. The most impossible thing they could have thought of. Which, of course, is all in their favor.
This cashier was in trouble. Owed money in large amounts. He had the combination of the safe.
Yes, I wouldn't pay much attention to his story alone, but I can't get round Danny. He's a simple-minded old fellow with a tremendous sense of duty. Can't see him as a criminal accessory at all. I believe he's absolutely positive he saw this manager.
And yet, the manager was in Portage at the time. By the way, did you see him just now?
Yes, he's back. I had to talk to him. He seems like a man in a dream. There's no doubt about that alibi. At 11 o'clock, he was making a speech in full view of 30 or 40 people who've known him for years.
Did you ask him about this statement of Danny's?
Yes, but he just smiled at me in a puzzled way. I felt rather foolish. Because, Marsh, there's no getting away from it. That man was in Portage last night and not at the bank.
Yes, there's no getting away from that.
Take it the other way around. Question of identity here at the bank.
Yes, it's just as certain at this end. Even if Danny made a mistake, Mason the cashier saw the man in the light and talked to him. Also, he had the combination of the vault.
We don't know that, Marshal. Suppose Danny made a mistake, but Mason didn't.
Oh, you mean it might have been a confederate of Mason's who fooled Danny?
No, that's no use. If Mason wanted to rob the bank, why would he need a confederate?
That's true.
Another thing. I can't get over the finding of that package of bonds outside the vault. And what puzzles me still more is the disorder in the vault itself. That seems to favor Mason.
Why's that?
Can you imagine any trained bank official throwing stuff around like that?
Not unless it was done on purpose.
It doesn't make sense.
Any theory, Sergeant?
Yes. There's only one that would fit this case and explain everything. But it needs just one little link of some sort before I'd even talk about it. Hello? Who's this? Why, hello, Bridget. What's the matter?
Oh, I just come from seeing Danny. Is there anything you can do to save him?
We're doing our best, Bridget.
Oh, but he never done it, Mr. Blair. You know that. Sure, and I ran all the way from Mr. Fishbury's when I heard
Mr.
it.
Mr. Fishbury's? What are you doing there?
Oh, don't you know? I'm his housekeeper. Him being a bachelor and all. I go into work there every day.
That's interesting. Did you see him last night?
No, sir. Not after I packed his things to go to Portage.
Did he take a big fur-lined coat with him?
Aye. It's funny. He took 3 sorts of clothes and 2 overcoats.
Three? Here, hold on. What were they?
Well, there was the clothes he was a-wearing, and then his dress clothes, and the suit he wears to the bank in the daytime.
Did you pack that one?
Sure I did. I don't know why.
Holy smoke, that's got it.
What is it, Sergeant?
That's what I wanted. We've got him. Come on, hurry up, Marshal.
Well, for mercy's sake.
You have heard episode 19 of Blair of the Mounties. The second and concluding part of this story will be told in episode 20 of this series.
The Mounties, a story of the Royal Canadian Mounted Police.
We present the 20th episode in Blair of the Mounties, being the second part of the story of the Canada Western Bank robbery. In the first part of our story, news of the robbery of over $100,000 in currency breaks. 2 men are arrested on suspicion. Mason, the bank cashier, an old Danny McVennon, the night watchman, an ex-member of the Mounties. Blair goes into action in defense of old Danny. As our scene opens, we find Blair and Marshall discussing the case at police barracks.
But, Sergeant, Do you mean to say that you have the solution to this thing?
Yes, I've got the solution.
And you know who did it?
Yes, I know who did it.
Well, but I don't follow all this.
Now, have a little patience, Marshal. I've given the lead to the city police. It's their job, you see. And if my idea works out, we ought to know something in a little while. In the meantime, let's go over the whole case. Perhaps you'll see what I'm driving at. Now, what happened first? And mind you, don't miss the little
thing. The first thing was that Danny McBrennan, night watchman at the bank, states that at 11:05 last night, the manager, Blake Fishbury, drove up to the bank in a cab.
Anything suspicious in that statement?
Well, not suspicious, but unreasonable. Fishbury was proved to be out of town at that time, attending a public function where lots of prominent people saw him.
And what do you conclude from that?
That Danny was either lying or that he was mistaken.
Or that he wasn't mistaken and wasn't lying.
But that's impossible.
Well, we'll pass that up for the present. What's the next item in Danny's statement?
He said that the bank manager gave him a $10 bill, sent him to the Craven Hotel for some cigars. The Craven House is 12 blocks away from the bank, and it took Danny 20 minutes.
Yes. Now we switch over to the statement of Mason, the cashier. He was working late in the bank. He, too, swears that Fishborough, the manager, came in at about 11:05 and chased him off to bed. Mason immediately went upstairs to his quarters over the bank, or so he says.
It's funny that neither of these men remarked on their surprise at seeing the manager back from his trip.
Bravo, Marshal, that's an important point. It brings up a possibility, but we'll pass that one, too. Let's get on. What next?
The next thing is that Danny gets back with the cigars and finds the manager gone. That makes him suspicious. He goes upstairs and gets Mason, the cashier. Mason spots a package of bonds that must have come out of the safe, opens the vault, and finds the currency gone.
All right. The city police arrest both Danny and Mason on suspicion. What's the case against them?
The case against Mason is that he knew the combination of the vault. He slept above the bank and had no alibi. In fact, he admits being there at the time.
Yes, now the case against Danny.
The case against Danny looks bad. The $10 bill he claims the manager gave him for the cigars was one that had been put into the vault when it was closed that afternoon. It's a mixed-up business.
Yes, anyhow, here's Andy McCross of the city police in a deuce of a hurry. Let's hear what he has to say.
Good morning.
Hello, Mac. What can I do for you?
You can give me an explanation. The whole city's swarming with Mounties checking up on the Canada Western case.
You don't tell me.
You better call them off or there's going to be trouble.
Me call them off? Well, I'm not running the force, Mac.
No, but you're at the bottom of all this foolery. I tell you, we got that night watchman, Danny McBrennan, cold, and Mason, too. They're remanded for trial at the Assizes.
So I heard. Well, you see, Mac, Danny used to belong to our lot. And naturally, the boys are out to do what they can. But if you have a case against them, of course, it's all right.
Now, what's wrong with the case, anyway?
Better sit down, Mac. We were just talking it over. What do you think of this story that Mason and Danny told?
You mean about the manager himself stealing that money and giving Danny the $10 bill for the cigar?
Yes.
You don't mean to tell me you believe that story.
I do, Mac.
Why, the thing's ridiculous.
Yes. Too ridiculous to be a lie.
What do you mean?
Just think it over, Mac. Mason the cashier is a pretty smart chap. If he was cooking up a story, it's funny he wouldn't think up a better one than that.
I don't see anything funny in it.
All right, we'll have the best lawyer in Canada to defend old Danny. Wait till he starts on that case of yours. I have an idea you'll see the joke.
See here, Sergeant. Have we not always worked with you before now?
Yes, I know what's coming, Mac. All good policemen should stick together.
Well,
eh?
But no...
Now, forget it, Mac. That stuff is out. We're working for Danny. I was bluffing just now when I talked about hiring a lawyer. That won't be necessary.
Why not?
Because I think we're going to have this case cleaned up before night. And Danny will be a free man.
No, see here, Sergeant. If you have a line on anybody for this thing, I have a right to know it.
I wouldn't be too sure of that, Mac.
But I'm sure of it. And another thing. You've got 50 men out on this watching the roads and the trains out of the city and checking up hotels. And if you don't pull them off, there'll be a complaint into the commissioner by noon from the mayor of the city.
See here, Andy McCross. You try to pull that comic policeman stuff on me, I'll make you and your whole outfit look like 30 cents before the day's out.
But hold on now. What's the trouble?
The trouble is the arrest of Danny McBrennan. He was in the police. There's a dozen or more of us here on this station that served with Danny through the storm and the cold up in the Arctic. Danny never told a lie in his life. You've got a nerve to arrest a man like Danny.
Oh, no, I begin to see.
Well, don't strain yourself, Mac.
Well, what is it you want, anyway?
I want Danny out of that jail.
But listen here, I cannot do that, Sergeant. They want a low bail. It's a serious charge.
I'm not talking about bail. Release him to our custody. We'll be responsible. If he's wanted, he'll be here. Then we'll help you on this case.
Well, maybe we might fix it up for you.
Better get busy and send Danny down here. I want to talk to him.
I'll do my best, Sergeant. But man to man now. Could you know just give me a line on what you got on this case?
Not while Danny's in jail, Mac. But I'll do this much. See this man wanted notice?
Sure. We'll have it ourselves. There's so many of them that I haven't had the time to be studying them all.
Well, just take a good look at this one. It's important.
John McNaughton, alias William Grover, wanted for burglary and assault in St. Paul, Minnesota.
Yes, he caught the body illegally 2 days ago. He's up here, Mac, and while we're talking of him, he's the man we have all the patrols after. It's an immigration case, so you can forget about that complaint.
Did you pick him up?
No, we let him through. Wanted to see what he was after. Take a look at his picture, Mac. Forget the mustache. Ever see him before?
Well, no. Can't say that exactly. Know him yourself?
No, but he's very like somebody I'm interested in.
But what's that got to do with a Canada Western case?
Never mind that now. Go and get Denny.
Well, I let him out on a public order for questioning, and in the meantime, perhaps I can feel a release of custody.
All right, hurry up.
Look here, Sergeant. I wish you'd tell me something.
What is it, Martin?
Is this just a bluff, or has this man McNaughton really got anything to do with the Canada Western case?
I think he's the man who got that $100,000, Marshal.
But what have you got on him?
Nothing yet. Only that he looks like the sort of man who would do it.
What? Looks like? Oh, but look here, Sergeant. You can't pull a man for that.
No, we'd want something more. But the whole basis of this crime is personal appearance. Just think a minute. Fishburne's alibi depends on that. And the story of Mason and Danny rests on the fact that the robber looked like the manager.
Yes, there's something in that.
Well, never mind that now. Let's go and have lunch. Danny will be here when we get back, and it's going to be a very amusing afternoon.
I tell you, I have to see him. Sure didn't he send for me?
Here's Danny, Sergeant.
Oh, hello, Danny. Come in. How are you feeling?
Well, you know, Sergeant, it was mighty fine of you to get me out of that jail.
That's all right, Danny.
But listen now. It's not over yet. And don't you be troubling about me. I can face the music, Peter.
I know, Danny, but you won't have to do that. They got you out, you're going to stay out. Now, just answer me one question. When you searched the manager's office last night, what did you find?
There weren't a thing out of place.
But in that little room behind the office. Get this down, Marshal.
Well, yes, it's a little room with a sofa in it and a wash basin.
What did you find there?
Well, there was a grey suit thrown on the sofa. It's Mr. Fishberry's. Sure, I hung it up on the stand.
That's all. Did you phone McCross, Marshal?
Yes. I told him to ask Mr. Fishberry to go over to the city police station for an interview. He'd be there by now.
All right. And what about that other thing?
I fixed that up, too. Sent Forsyth and Palmer down with a warrant to arrest John McNaughton in room 47, Craven Hotel. If he was there, they should have him down to the city police headquarters by now.
Good. We ought to be hearing from our friend Mac pretty soon.
What can they do without any evidence, Sergeant? And we better be going down. McCross is expecting you.
No, I'm going to stay here, Marshal. I'm interested to hear what happens when that bank manager sees McNaughton.
But what about all this evidence? Hadn't we better get it into shape?
Somehow I don't think we'll need it, Marsh. Not at present, anyway. If those two men come together, I believe we'll get the whole story without any questioning.
Sergeant.
Hello? Hello, Mac, what's wrong?
Why, I never saw such a thing in my life.
What?
We got the bank manager down to the station, and we were strolling around waiting for you. And when the door flew open, and them boys of yours brought in McNaughton.
Good. What happened?
Ah, come away now, you can find what happened. This fellow McNaughton's the dead spitting image of Fishborough, where there's a like as two peas.
But what happened?
They flew at their throats, and when I got him apart in 5 minutes, we had the whole story. Listen, who is this McNaughton fella? He might be the twin brother of the other man.
Not only might be, but he is. Did you get that money?
Sure, we got the most of it. The boys find it down in McNaughton's room.
Well, that's that.
Come on, Danny, my lad. We'll go down and make out the release for you.
I will not. Listen now, Andy McCross. I'm going out for a drink with Sergeant Blair. Go away and get your dirty papers. Bring them into the office and wait till I get back.
Well, whatever you say.
Hold on now, Sergeant. There's just one or two things I can't get in this case. Is this McNaughton really twin brother to Fishborough?
Yes, he's his brother. He tried to blackmail the manager. Fishborough was in trouble, so he planned that robbery.
Well, what about that new $10 bill he gave Danny? Or rather, I suppose it was the brother who gave it to him. How did he get it before the safe was robbed?
He got it out of the bundle that came in that day.
But the teller checked the numbers.
Checked them, yes. He looked at the starting and finishing numbers.
I see. What's the importance of the gray suit?
Oh, that wasn't important. Just the link that put me onto the plot. Fishborough took that gray suit for his brother to put on. The brother didn't use it. But when he got to the bank, he threw it out of the grip to make room for the money.
Yes, it all fits in.
Yes. Come on, Danny.
I'll be with you, Sergeant.
You have heard episode 20 in Blair of the Mounties. Tune in for the next episode in this series entitled The Goose Lake Robbery.
the Mounties from June 6, 1938, Part 1, and July 25, 1938 for Part 2. I hope you've enjoyed the programming tonight, and we'll finish off with the High Swiss Yodel from Wilf Carter.
There once was a happy Swiss, Swiss, Swiss upon the mountain high, who used to ski the mountain tops and yodel lullaby. The moon above and the stars in love and the silvery Milky Way would send their beauty downward on his little Swiss chalet. High Swiss yodel, that's what I want to hear. High Swiss yodel, I can never be your dear. Find another Swiss, give her a kiss and I take her for your miss. She'll be your bride, stay by your side, for life is full of bliss. He hunted high and he hunted low and he hasn't found a date. His heart is broken, cause you see he's longing for a mate. The moon above and the stars in love and the silvery Milky Way still send their beauty downward on his little Swiss chalet. High Swiss yodel, that's what I want to hear. High Swiss yodel, I can never be your dear. Find another Swiss, give her a kiss and I take her for your miss. She'll be your bride, stay by your side, for life is full of bliss.
Okay, Bob, thanks a lot and great work. I hope each and every one of our listeners enjoyed your inaugural program. But as usual and as always, I must do what I do best, and that is shut things down and wrap it up for this week's broadcast of Michael's Saturday Night Surprise. But don't worry, we will be back again next week. So hopefully the Thanksgiving holiday comes and goes so very, very joyous and gracious for each and every one of you. And who knows, maybe we might have a little Thanksgiving OTR surprise lined up for you guys. Or who knows, maybe we'll take off. I don't know. We'll have to get that in the meeting next week. But anyway, if you have any questions, comments, complaints, requests, or any of that sort, please address them not to me, because, you know, that's above my pay grade, but to Miguel Amato, the MSS director. He can be found at MikeAmeli at earthlink.net. That's MikeAmeli @earthlink.net. We will soon be releasing the key and returning the room to you, the listening audience. Please do with it as you wish for as long as you wish. But just remember, be nice to one another. Otherwise, you know, we're going to have to fire Bob, you know, so be nice. On behalf of myself and the rest of the MSS crew, have a great night, a great weekend, a great holiday, and goodbye.